Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton of the International Culinary Center. And today, we are not broadcasting from Bushwick, Brooklyn. We are at Manresa in Los Gatos, California, where it is sunny and absolutely beautiful. And I'm sitting here with Chef David Kinch, which every chef in America knows who David Kinch is. But if you're out there and do not know David Kinch, he's one of the most talented chefs in the world right now, and he's been known a lot to the foodie crowd because in 2010 he won the James Beard Award for Best Chef in the Pacific. In 2010, Manresa, his iconic restaurant out here, got 2 Michelin stars. In only 2009 he was a rising star chef for Food and Wine, and he's made the top 50 world's best restaurants from Restaurant Magazine, Gourmet, and the San Pellegrino of 50 top restaurants in the world. And, of course, the San Francisco Chronicle, his local, gave him 4 stars. And this week is his 10th anniversary, so I'm so excited to be here. David, I just can't wait to jump in and talk to you about how all this came about and how you became a chef. Welcome.
No, thank you, Dorothy. Thanks for including me in this. This is great.
Okay, well, I hear you're a New Orleans boy.
No, I grew up in New Orleans. I went to school, not originally. I was born in Philadelphia. But I traveled a lot in the Deep South. My father moving around. I spent what I call my formative years in New Orleans, and certainly the place where I developed my love for the restaurant business and the love of good food.
So, what ages were you in New Orleans?
I was there from the time I was 15 to about 22.
Oh, so those were really formative palate years.
Yes.
So when did you develop a love for Cajun cooking, Creole cooking, or did you have a palate back then?
Well, you started working in restaurants. Yeah, I started working in restaurants because, flexible hours. I could work on weekends. I could work after school, work in the evenings and that sort of thing. And I just kind of fell into it. I fell in love with the excitement. There were the same reason everybody else who's in the industry for a long time is.
Now, wait a minute. GQ magazine said you were a waiter first, and then you were watching the guys in the kitchen, and they were talking loud and bad.
Well,
and that was more exciting for you.
I started working in the back of the house. I was doing some dishwashing work and busing work at some casual family type restaurants, and then I started training as an assistant waiter at a very nice restaurant then at that time. And I realized very quickly that the front of the house and customer relations was not my forte. And I found myself spending more and more time and showing more and more interest in actually what was going on in the back of the house. And I was fascinated by they were being creative. I saw great food in the dining room, but I saw the atmosphere that it was coming out of and the fact that people were being creative and they were working quickly because they had a timeline, and they were working with fire and they were being creative and they were causing a certain amount of happiness and pleasure for guests. And I found this fascinating, and that's what drew me to it. To this day I like working with my hands and being able to be spontaneous and creative.
So your father was a civil engineer.
Yes, he worked for the same company, an oil company, for most of his life. We spent a good part of our young lives traveling around a lot, not spending a lot of time in places moving around from school to school. I have never viewed that as any kind of detriment in any kind of way. I think it's where I kind of got my wanderlust.
And did you sample food? Was food a part of that? Were your parents foodies? Did they expose you to...
I mean, you know,
regional cuisines.
Well, I mean, we were coming from Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, and going to the Deep South. I mean, you know, we learned a lot about a lot of different foods and regional foods very, very quickly. You know, it was a part of our lives. It wasn't a major part of our lives. It certainly wasn't a foodie culture kind of thing. But
Did you have an aha moment when you said, "Oh my gosh, this food is, you know, really complex. It's really compelling. It's really..."
Well, I think, no, when I started working in kitchens, and I realized how deep it was in terms of, learning and knowledge, I think moving around a lot as a kid, I kind of developed, encouraged my wanderlust. And I think one of the reasons I was attracted originally was, so I thought it would be a good opportunity to see the world. You know, mm-hmm. You can cook anywhere, you can move around, perhaps work for a hotel chain or something like that. That's how I remember thinking about it. And then in New Orleans, this was a long time ago. I mean, we're talking about the mid to late 70s. So, you know, France was kind of, you know, the Holy Grail. And I became really fascinated with French food and French restaurant culture, and did a lot of reading. Quentin Blake's book, The Great Chefs of France, was a real turning point for me, reading that book. I had that book memorized, you know, the handwritten menus in the back. There was this whole menu section in the back of the book. And just reading about it was just this huge education for me. And it just made me want to go to France, somehow to figure out a way to go to France.
Was it the chefs in France and their attitude towards food, or was it the product in France?
It's probably a little bit of both. You know, the fundamental tenets, you know, that I think we try to follow today here at Manresa. And I think it's one of the fundamental themes that all great restaurants share, regardless of location, is a certain amount of respect for the product, great product, mm-hmm. and treating it respectfully. And I think that's what really resonated with me, you know, reading that book and others, at that time. And
what was it about the chefs, though, in that book?
They were doing food that I just found amazing. You know, I certainly wasn't able to taste it. You know, I was reading it. I was reading, you know, at the end of working every day, and back in New Orleans at that time, and then off to culinary school. And I think it was just, they had this great dedication to offering pleasure to people. And this was really the start where chefs started becoming known. You know, this is the area, this is the time of Bocuse and Gérald and
Verger.
Yeah, and Verger, guys who were all of a sudden they were in the media, and they were using the media to promote. And it was a major turning point, you know, of course, in our industry, in that it's where the chefs really kind of came out from the shadows and mm-hmm. from the restaurateurs or the front of the house. And instead of just being, you know, the anonymous workers in the kitchen, they started to step out to the forefront. Mm. So I think, of course, there was a certain amount of attraction with that also.
Mm-hmm. So you were working in various restaurants in New Orleans and then decided to go to Europe or go to school? Or how did unfold?
Yeah, you know, I decided, you know, there was a point where I decided, you know, this is what I wanted to do. I did it at a fairly young age, and I decided, you know, I wanted to be a chef. I wanted to work with food, and I went to culinary school right out of high school. I went up to Johnson Wales up in Providence. I was mm-hmm. up there for 2 years, 1980 and 81. You know, mm-hmm. I'm sure I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but you know, culinary schools have changed dramatically in the, not only in the past 25 years, but even just the past 10 years, you know, the way mm-hmm. curriculum and mm-hmm. how it's changed. So I went up there, and I came back to New Orleans for a year and worked, I did an externship, and then I came back and worked for a year, and then I moved to New York City. And New York was, of course, kind of the Holy Grail, at least in the United States.
Was that when you went to Quilted Giraffe?
No, I didn't start, I didn't get to the Quilted Giraffe until after I got back from Europe the first time. went up to New York. I worked at a couple places. I ended up in a small bistro in the upper East Side called La Petite Farum.
Oh, I remember.
Yeah, used to be right next to an American Place, right mm-hmm. there on Lexington, between I guess it was 70, 71. Mm-hmm. And the owner of the place had a family restaurant. It was run by his brother in Burgundy. And my deal was that I would spend a year working for him under the assumption.
France?
Yeah, in New York, and then I would have the opportunity to go and work for the family business in France. And I viewed that as my end to my first externships in France. So that's how it
started.
So
is that how you got to the Hotel de la Poste?
That's how I got to the Hotel de la Poste. Which was fantastic.
In Bonn, France. He's in the heart of the Burgundy wine country there.
And yes, and then I had the opportunity to actually start to eat at these restaurants I had been reading about for the past 5 or 6 years.
What was that like? Did it live up to your expectations?
Well, you know, the first one I went to, of course, was Bocuse. You know, Bocuse was, you know, the emperor. You know, he was the one, it's the one where you gravitated towards. And, you know, I remember meeting him, you know, him coming out to the table for the first time. And it's, you know, you kind of shake, you know, you're a young person and you've been reading about someone like that. And it was a great meal. I really had a transformative meal on that trip, on that first.
Where was that?
At a restaurant called Alain Chapelle.
In
Mionnais. And
that was 2-star Michelin.
It was three. And, you know, he was part of this whole Bonda Bocuse group of chefs, you know, had trained under Ferdinand Poiron and gone out and had really kind of elevated and were the next generation of what was going on in France at that time. They were kind of the basis of the Nouvelle Cuisine at that point in time. But Chapelle...
Wait, let's explore that a little bit for our listeners. So Ferdinand Poiron had a restaurant called La Pyramide outside of Lyon, and it was considered the greatest, probably, restaurant in France, one of the greatest restaurants.
Certainly before war, you know, pre and post World War II.
Right.
He was self-taught. He kind of broke out of the mold of Carême and Escoffier. You know, he really focused in on regionality and restaurants having a regional character and being reflective of where they are. He started from scratch every day. And
You mean restaurateurs didn't do that back then?
Well, you know, speaking in generalizations, you know, hotels and large kitchens, you know, French cuisine was very codified at that time. You know, things were done a certain way. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't do it that way, then you were doing it wrong. And I think Poiron was a cook who went by taste, and he was inspired by ingredients. And he was inspired by where he was. He had no interest in traveling anywhere.
So he was doing a nouvelle cuisine.
Well, yes, then. You know, he was a new generation.
Nouvelle cuisine means new cuisine, right?
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, it's, you know, in France, you know, you had Carême and moving into Escoffier, who did a lot about sanitation and codifying and what a brigade was and how to be efficient, how to get things done and. A certain sense of, you know, what it meant to put on a chef's coat, that it was that you weren't a domestic, you weren't a slave, you weren't just a lowly servant of sorts, but it was a respected profession. And of course, Escoffier realized that, you know, if he could elevate the profession, then it'd be a better profession, and he would attract better people to work, you know, and it wouldn't be the dregs of society, which, you know, let's face it, you know, for the longest time, you know, cooks were really the dregs of society. You know, it was a job that most people didn't want to do, and you didn't live a long time. You know, you're breathing, you know, you're breathing coal fires, and you're working in terrible conditions. Yes, of course. Of course. And so Escoffier, you know, a lot of people talk about the greatness and the genius of Escoffier, but my opinion is Escoffier, the greatest contribution he has made, you know, even though he has this tremendous repertoire of recipes, was his codifying of what it meant to be a cook and the efficiency of a kitchen and, you know, meat stations and entremets and you don't wear your uniform out of the kitchen and, you know, you present yourself as a professional, you'll be paid as a professional.
He was a military man, wasn't he? Didn't he cook for a general?
He cooked for a lot of people. He cooked for a lot of royalty. You know, he... He cooked for a lot of royal families. You know, the base, most of his career was in London, you know, which was a big media center there. And I think that's really why he made his name. He's very famous in New York. He did a lot of cooking in New York.
Oh, really? I didn't realize he would come to New York. Yeah. Okay, let's get back to you. But I had no idea you're such a historian. This is really fascinating. But it's really goes into your DNA of a chef, of the way you look at it as yourself as a professional.
And well, I think it's, you know, it's like in any profession, it's great to be creative. It's great. It's wonderful to be forward thinking and trying new ideas. But just like in many other artistic endeavors or a craftsmanship, it's always great to have a basic understanding and a foundation and of the traditions of where you came from. You know, it's easy to throw out old traditions and the way people used to do it before. You throw it out and say, that's old fashioned. But you can't throw it away unless you know what it was. You know, you have to know what you're throwing away. You know, you can't paint an abstract painting by splattering paint on a canvas if you can't draw a figure. You know, you have to decide you don't want to paint a figure after you painted figures and you learned to master it and you learned the craft and the discipline of what has come before you can decide whether you want to reject it or not. And it's something you can see through very quickly with a cook or a chef or anybody else.
How long does it take to be a chef?
I'm still learning.
But to all the young chefs out there, what do you think they have to do to get to the stage to say, okay, I'm ready to take on my own restaurant, my own style? Because there's some kids that come out of school and they want to open a restaurant right away and they really have no experience. They've learned a few techniques. What does it take to be a chef of your stature? To really be the top of the game, to really understand that craftsmanship. I know you're still learning every day. Even Andre Soltner tells me he's still learning every day. But when do you get to that point where you can have the self-confidence to say, I'm ready to open my own place and have my own style?
Well, you know, you can answer that two ways. You know, in terms of cooking, you know, and your own style, I mean, developing your own style is... you know, Ferran Adrià said that he always broke down cooking into and learning and developing your own style into three stages. And the first one was what he called imitation. Imitation is where you went out and you imitated the people you idolized or what you felt attracted to. You know, maybe you work for someone, a mentor, and you're so enamored with the style and how much you have learned that you imitate it because it's what you know. And, you know, you probably master that style. And the next one is assimilation. So and assimilation is that you start to have your own ideas, but you're still building upon what you've learned from the person, these mentors, and what you've been imitating. And you start to feel a little bit more confident and maybe probably spreading your wings a little bit. But you're still... for lack of a better word, derivative. You know, derivative, I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, mm-hmm. but it means like people will perhaps eat your food and they will know where it came from. They will know that you have put your own spin on it, mm-hmm. but they will know where the genesis of the food is. Mm-hmm. And the last step is innovation. And innovation happens when you have this accumulation of influences, not only from people who you work for, but as you've gotten older and you become more mature, whether it's travel experiences, what you read, perhaps other interests that have influenced in how you cook, but most importantly, a certain sense of self-confidence in your abilities, that your style becomes your own. So imitation, assimilation, and innovation, I think, are three very relevant steps in describing how a personal style comes to take place. And I'm always fascinated by the last one, innovation, because usually when the self-confidence and the maturity is there in a cook, the food tends to be at its most simple. You know, at that point in time, the cook has realize that he doesn't have to be showy, he doesn't have to put a lot of things on the plate, that he can back off and through his own skills and his maturation, which he has learned to have respect for and confidence in his ability to cook, he realizes he doesn't have to make it complicated, he can make it simple. And when that happens, then you realize you really have to use great ingredients, because at that point, then you have no place to hide. So I think an understanding for really, truly great ingredients, and everybody talks about, you know, I go to the market, you know, market cuisine, it's seasonal. But you know what? There is an upper echelon. There is a certain percentage of ingredients that really are the best in the world. And cooks are not alchemists. We cannot take mediocre product or product that everyone else uses and through the magic or the skill and the wonderfulness of us being chefs can transform it into a great product. Because once you've mastered the skills, really the only best way to improve the dish and make the dish better is actually to take the fundamental building blocks, the ingredients, and improving the quality of the ingredients or the seasonality or whatever. And then it gets more complex. Then you talk about regionality, you know, cooking where you're from. You know, a tomato on the West Coast versus a tomato on the East Coast. You know, why would I import East Coast tomatoes? The food, it just wouldn't make sense in that context. Then you mentioned when do you know well, at that point, then I think you realize that being a cook and being a chef and then moving on to being a restaurateur or being in charge of a restaurant, that is when you get this horrible realization that cooking is the easiest part of your job at that point.
Okay. Because we're gonna pick up on that thread, but we've got to stop right now and take a little break, and we'll be back with David Kinch. David, I've never heard that so well said about, you know, the evolution of a chef. I can't wait to get back to the second half here. Okay, this is heritageradionetwork.org, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center. We're talking with David Kinch out at Manresa in Los Gatos, California. We'll be back in a minute.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and I'm speaking with David Kinch, the incredible chef out at Manresa in Los Gatos, California. And we were just speaking, David, about when does a chef know he or she is ready to take on their own restaurant and start their own style?
Well, I think, you know, at some point in time, you decide that, you know, you're no longer going to work for anybody. You're going to be your own boss. And I think you come to very strong realization at that point that the cooking aspect is the easiest part of your life, your job at that point. And then it becomes an understanding of management and motivating people and motivating staff, because you will realize that you're only as good as the people who work for you and who you inspire to carry out your vision, because it's not just one person. I think learning to delegate certain aspects of the business is a big part of the maturation project, not micromanaging every single thing. You don't. Especially nowadays, different people are motivated in different ways. Some people, you have to grab them by the ears and bang their head against the wall for them to understand what you're saying. And other people, you know, they need a brotherly arm around the shoulder, and you need to whisper gently into their ear about what you want them to do, and it's not what they're doing the way they're doing it now. So learning how to motivate people and getting the best out of them and creating a team, to this day, it was the last thing I learned how to do. I'm still learning how to do it. But it's also the most difficult part of the job.
It is
motivating people.
And when you figure it out, you can teach at Harvard Business School. Right? Because what you're saying is, and chef actually in French means chief. Mm-hmm. And the head of a bank in France is called a chef. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Americans realize that.
Yeah, chefs are wrong in the dining room. They're called.
Right? You're a manager. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's let's get to your restaurant here. mannerism. I want to ask you, you more than almost any other chef I've ever met have spent a lot of time traveling through the world, and not only that, spending significant amount of time in great restaurants in many different... You've been in Spain, Germany, France, Japan. Give us a short, like, global history of your... What did you pick up from each of these restaurants and how long you were there?
Well, I went on a... in the early 90s, after doing some work in New York and moving out to the West Coast, I was kind of at an impasse, I felt, in my learning. I was in my late 20s. I decided I would take a trip, see the world, and work in some restaurants. This was before the internet, you know, where this, you know, it was really easy to set up a stage. You wrote letters. Remember letters? You
know, yes, right.
You know, I picked 10 restaurants, 10 or 12 restaurants. I wrote them all letters. I paid someone to translate the letters into the original language out of showing respect, and you mailed. And then you wait by the mailbox, you know. You waited by the mailbox for a response, you know. And I, you know, maybe 50% of the people I wrote to even responded. Half of them said no. And the ones who said yes, you know, those are the ones that I went to. At that time, I was, when I was working in New York, a restaurant called the Quilted Giraffe, they closed for the entire month of July. So for about 3 or 4 years, I was traveling, you know, for a month in Spain. And it really wasn't necessarily for culinary purposes, though, you know, I learned a lot about the traditional products just before this whole postmodernist food explosion was happening in Spain. And people were eating very traditional, you know, it was ham and just a very regional cuisine. And it was great. It was really, really nice. But I became enamored with what was going on in the Basque Country. I had spent some time in San Sebastian, so I knew I definitely wanted to work there. So that's why I chose Spain. France, obviously, was the no-brainer. And when I was in New York, there was a great German chef who came through the Quilted Giraffe Kitchen, dropped off some of the books that had come from their property, and they were really gorgeous, and the food looked amazing. And I wrote them a letter, and they responded well too. So I said,
"How long were you in Germany?"
I was in Germany for about 5 months.
What's this? You know, you don't hear much about German food cuisine. What was it like there?
Great product. You know, they brought great product in from all over. A lot of their product was from Rungis, but you know, we were in at the Frankfurt Market 3 times a week in a van at 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, mm-hmm. The cooks took turns doing that.
Wait, so Rungis is the big market outside of Paris.
That's correct.
So
but it supplies most of Europe. I mean,
it
you
does?
Know, it's yeah, yeah. You know, it doesn't. I shouldn't say it supplies most of Europe, but it has a reputation of being like an epicenter for a lot of the very best product coming out. And
so, how did you get to Japan?
I got to Japan. I went and worked in a restaurant in it was actually a Western-style restaurant. It was in Fukuoka, which is the largest city on the southernmost major island of Kyushu. Oh. And I got hooked up there through a regular customer at the Quilted Giraffe. Quilted Giraffe, of course, was one of the first restaurants in the United States to incorporate a real kind of Asian aspects to the food at that time. And Barry Wine at the time was very enamored with Japan. I kind of picked up on that myself. I was eating a lot of Japanese food at that time. I still do. I'm fascinated by the flavors that they get using absolutely no fat or a certain minimal amount of fat, which, you know, occupies a lot of my time thinking that through and figuring out how they do that, you know, in such a diverse... But anyway, in any case, I was looking for an opportunity to go and live over there. And
How long did you live over there?
I was over there for about 4 months. Uh-huh. And it would have been longer. I had visa troubles. You know, I had some issues. I had originally planned to stay for a couple of years, but I came back. I came back unexpectedly. I ended up being in San Francisco. I worked a couple of places in San Francisco.
You were at the Mandarin Oriental.
I was at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel. This is before this long extended period in Europe. And after I got back from Europe, I opened up my first restaurant in Saratoga here in the South Bay. I originally intended to open in San Francisco. Really couldn't find anything that I liked or afford.
Yeah, that's the issue with the cities.
You know, with the first, we opened up in Saratoga. On the proverbial shoestring.
Well, how much did it cost to open that first restaurant?
God, it was maybe $130,000.
Wow.
It's small, 30 seats, an old building, a kitchen the size of a closet. And, you know, it was busy from the day we opened our doors. We kind of were at the right place at the right time, Silicon Valley, 1995. The market was booming. The economy was going great.
That was Sansovi. Did you name it?
Yes.
So what does that mean?
Sansovi is the name of a Catalan language cookbook from 13th century. Unknown Catalan author. He's believed to have been a cook in the English royal court. At that time, it was considered the most influential cooking manual or cookbook of in the world at the time before the discovery of the New World. It was fascinating that the recipes were codified. There were pictures and diagrams of fish from the Mediterranean along with the Latin names and the best ways to prepare them. So it was really encyclopedic in its approach. And, you know, you can still buy it today. It's still in print today.
So what? So that really grabbed you? Did you was it inspirational for the food you were doing there?
Yeah. You know, I was good. You know, at this point in time, you know, we were, I mean, this is 1995. We were cooking a lot of, you know, we the food had a real kind of Catalan, you know, inflection in it at that time because it was something I was really interested in. Actually, Sansovi was the working title while we were making the name. We figured we would pick a more manageable name by the time we opened up. But that of course, became the least of our worries. And when it came time to decide.
So 30 seats, how many people in the kitchen?
We had like four.
That's a lot.
Well, that's including a dishwasher.
Oh, okay. No, I meant cooks.
It was just me and two other cooks. Someone doing pastry and but we were doing tasting menus out of that.
Really?
Yeah. It's and you know we developed quite a following. You know, we got good press, and we were busy. But you know after 6 or 7 years working out of such a small kitchen, some people can really do it, but I felt really limited by the space and not being able to get any bigger, at least in terms of the kitchen. We wanted to find a place that we weren't limited by
our kitchen
physical space.
Is that because you, in order to do the food that maybe your imagination goes to, you need equipment, and the equipment wouldn't fit in there? Is that?
Yeah, that's and you know the ability to move around and that sort of thing, and you know just not a lot of space. I mean, we had ideas, we knew what we wanted to do, and you know we wanted to be considered, you know, a great American restaurant. I just didn't think it was going to happen in that space. I was, you know, ever since I read and looked at The Great Chefs of France, you know, that Quentin Crewe book, Anthony Blake and Quentin Crewe, that's who it was. Every cook should have that book. You should find it. Find every, you know, it's out of print, obviously, but I think every cook should have a copy of that in their library. But I was fascinated. The book talked about all these great chefs from all over France and how the restaurants were reflective of where they were. You know, Brittany, they used Brittany products. You know, south of France, you know, they used certain product that you just simply wouldn't use. You learned about how cuisine was broken down by regionalities, broken down by fats. You know, in the southwest, you had pork and goose fats. You had olive oil in the south. And, of course, you used butter and dairy products in the north. And you realize, you know, you started thinking about it in an American context, you know, and that's what always attracted me. Well, why can't American restaurants, great American restaurants like these ones I'm reading about, why can't we have these restaurants in the United States? Why can't we have a regional cuisine in America? And then you start to read about it and you realize, well, we do have regional cuisines in America, but they've never really been celebrated or dug in deep. And of course, that is a generalization because, you know, we have heroes now. You know, people have written books, you know, for the past 150 years, you know, a lot of them by women, you know, who were home cooks. They weren't professional cooks, but they're the ones that kind of codified, you know, the Deep South. I mean, you have, you know, Low Country and then Cajun, and you have what goes on in Mississippi. You have Texas and the whole concept of, you know, slow cooking beef. I mean, you know, you can say the greatest culinary contribution America has ever made might be, you know, Texas barbecue. You're talking about brisket, the lowliest of cuts, salt and pepper and smoke, and the sublime. You know, it's a technique, and it's something that's been developed over time. And you know, you have the Pacific, Northwest, you have the Midwest, and of course you have California, where I am too, and the whole food revolution that has affected America that's happened in Northern California.
Okay, let's stop right there. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and see where you've taken that and how Manresa is maybe the ultimate American restaurant.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org is dedicated to providing the most up-to-date information and news on the food industry. Interviews with chefs and in-depth pieces on food systems take listeners literally from the farm to the fork. Can you hear this anywhere else? Nope. Press the donate button on our website and learn how you can become a founding member and support the station.
Welcome back. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today I'm interviewing David Kinch at his gorgeous restaurant Manresa in Los Gatos, California. And we're just getting to the stage where David's going to tell us how he took his love of product and expressing it with American ingredients. I understand you make your own fleur de sel. You go out on the ocean, you bring in buckets of water, and you dry your own salt. Mm-hmm. This is love of product. What? Tell us about.
Well, it's an excuse to not come to the restaurant and get out in the water.
Salt to the earth. Yeah, right. Well, first of all, Manresa is celebrating its 10th anniversary.
This week.
It's very exciting. Congratulations.
And speaking of Bushwick, you know, we actually have Carla Maracci in the kitchen right now cooking, you know, for tonight's dinner.
I know. It was so ironic to walk in here and see Carla. It was great. Tell us, what was the... First of all, Manresa, I believe, is the name of a Jesuit high school in New Orleans. Is there any connection between your New Orleans background and the...
It might be, but it has nothing to do with... You know, Manresa is a beach... it's a beach south of Santa Cruz, where I live. There's a Manresa beach, but Manresa is also a very large, you know, old Roman town outside of Barcelona, where the Jesuit order of monks, where Junipero Serra was from, who was the explorer who named the large part of the coast and founded the missions along the California coast. Oh. So that's that California-Catalan connection. We were looking for a Catalan name when we were moving Sansovia over to here. We wanted to keep kind of Catalan inflection, and I think we kind of lucked out in finding something that represented both where we came from and where we currently are.
Yeah, that's a perfect intersection. Yeah. Well, so tell us the menus at Manresa and the backbone of it with American ingredients. And we were going into American regionality and celebrating it. How do you celebrate it here?
I was born on the East Coast. I grew up in the South, but you know, I've lived the majority of my life at this point in California, in Santa Cruz. I don't know what that means, but it means something. It's really shoehorned in nicely with what I had learned about quality of ingredients and sourcing, which really kind of became the backbone of our philosophy and what we do here. And we kind of built on that. So you have this tremendous work that had been done, you know, starting with Wolfgang and Alice and Jeremiah Tower and a host of others that names that, you know, people don't hear about. But, you know, James Beard was originally from Portland, Oregon, you know, the whole West Coast. And everything has been about quality of ingredients, simple, almost kind of an outdoor kind of cooking. Grilling was kind of a stereotyped aspect of it, a rustic, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but it was kind of like the connotations of what was going on, and this abundance of product. You know, great migratory waves going through, the French and Italians in mid-19th century, you know, who planted all the vines. and all the olive trees along, you know, a good part of the coast of the West Coast, which is predominantly a Mediterranean climate. You know, we have dry and wet seasons. That's kind of how it works. It's, you know, we're more like the south of France than anything else out here. Not very temperate. And then, of course, you have the great Asian migrations also. And that's why I think in California we have the ability to really seamlessly combine elements from great Western European traditions and what's happening on the Pacific Rim, because they've been a big part of the development of the West Coast ever since the very beginning. They're not newcomers. I think these are great traditions to build on. Of course, the wine industry speaks for itself out here in California. I think the next great ingredient revolution you're going to see in California is all these olive trees out here. I think you're going to see an olive oil industry that is going to rival the best of any in the world, whether it's Greece, Spain,
France,
Italy, and of course
Italy.
You know, because you know you have huge groves out here, not necessarily of the right varietals. They planted varietals back then of trees that produced a lot of oil and decent oil, but not great oil. But they have been slowly over the past 30, 40 years, they have been transplanted to quality varietals. And, you know, of course, with the classic story of American ingenuity and hard work and maybe not getting it right the first time, but never giving up. And I think the next generation or so, you're just going to see some of the best oils in the world created out here. And I think this is a great example of why I'm here in California. You know, this spirit of wine and cooking fats, the great quality fruits and vegetables, which are really
Let's talk about that. You have Love Apple Farm. That's your farm.
Yes. Well, it's not my farm. It's the farm with Cynthia Sandberg and her partners. We have an exclusive partnership.
How exciting is that for a chef? And how do you work with the farm?
Well, it's certainly the most satisfying aspect of being a cook here at the restaurant, but it's also the most challenging because, you know, the menu changes fairly frequently here. A lot of my time is spent working with Cynthia and her team, not only deciding what to grow, but the amounts we want to grow. You know, we're trying to tailor the farm to the needs of the restaurant so we can be respectful and not wasteful for the obvious reasons. But we're constantly looking at product that works, products that don't work, products we want more of. But when we want cabbage, you know, we have to plan for cabbage. You know, we can't pick up the phone or go to the farmer's market. I mean, we can, and we're not trying to be dogmatic about it, but what we like to think of is, well, we'll create dishes with cabbage or fennel or whatever it may be, and we plan about three seasons ahead.
So you have to do your menu three seasons, or at least your product menu?
We do the product menu ahead. Mm. And, you know, we go and we walk through. We might walk by that bed of cabbage, you know, when it's, you know, just starting. And we look at it and say, oh, yeah, cabbage, you know. And every time you walk by, you know, it gets bigger and bigger. And then all of a sudden you get to this period where you realize, you know, I'm about ready to have a lot of cabbage coming to the restaurants. And we need to figure out how we're going to use it and how we're going to incorporate it into the menus. So sometimes that's really hard to do. But it's also incredibly satisfying to do it also.
Do you put vegetables up? Would you make sauerkraut?
Yes, of course. We
take your tomatoes.
We do everything we can to not waste anything. Mm. It's a big part of what we do.
So you have this whole farm at your disposal, and you're trying new things. For other chefs out there, how much of a financial burden is it?
It's a big one.
Is this sustainable?
Well,
you know, for a lot of people dream of that, and you hear freshness of product, and I think so many people are jealous that you have this growing season and this incredible farm. And it is biodynamic. It is incredible. It is beautiful.
They do tremendous work there. You know, Cynthia at the farm, she has this big educational program at the farm. They take a lot of farming externships. She takes externs in from people who work various agricultural programs all throughout the world. You know, a lot of them journey halfway around the world to come and spend 3 months working at the farm.
I know we take students from our Campbell School.
Yes, of course, from the Campbell School.
Where you're the dean. I forgot to mention, David is a dean at the International Culinary Center.
But, you know,
and we're lucky enough to take students out there.
It's really pretty amazing what's going on there. It's become an educational center. They're teaching over 100 classes a year there, everywhere from making macarons and traditional jam-making techniques to beekeeping, to urban chicken coops, backyard chicken raising, making your own soaps. It's really kind of a sustainability center, a homesteading center in the foothills of the mountains.
And so how does that translate on your menu? Tell us about a dish. Well, tell us maybe a dish that you're most proud of, one of them, that really expresses the essence of Manresa.
Okay, we have a dish that's, we have a signature, probably our one signature dish that's always on the menu, and it's called Into the Vegetable Garden. And it's always written like that on the menu, but the dish, ironically, changes every day. The dish is, of course, it is based upon an idea and a dish from a really great French chef, a guy named Michel Bras, and it has our own little spin on it. But what that dish is supposed to be, when that dish is, well, we want it to be an edible reflection on a daily basis of Love Apple Farms. In other words, if something is coming from Love Apple, then it needs to be on the plate in some sort of shape or form. And if it's not from Love Apple Farms, it can't be on the plate. And those are the only two rules for it. We have one and sometimes two people in the kitchen whose sole duties are this dish and separating everything out. And it usually has anywhere from about 40 to 60 ingredients on the plate.
Oh, my gosh.
And almost everyone has it in the dining rooms, both on both the tasting and the prefix menu. So, you know, we'll make 50, 60 of these a day, and they're made to order. And everything is placed on individually. It looks like a salad, but it's not a salad. And, you know, one day, Malabar spinach is available, and then it's out of season. Then it's no longer at the farm, or a specific cabbage leaf is not available or no longer, and then it goes off the dish. But when it comes in, it goes on the dish. And so they're constantly thinking about, they're responsible for ordering and making sure that the stuff comes in. That their whole job, their whole day is based on taking everything, still warm with the dirt on the roots, and transforming it to the plate, you know, a couple bites of 40 to 60 ingredients where every bite is completely different. So,
That is an amazing. So do you let the cooks decide that, or are you the final taster?
Final taster, but, you know, we're in a rhythm with the dish. You know, the dish starts with elements that are only root-based and cooked on the first, they're the first thing on the plate. Then we have raw roots on the plate. Then there's cooked leaves and stems. And there's raw leaves and stems. And then on the top are the flowers and the seeds from the various plants. So the dish itself actually resembles the ecosystem of plants.
Yes.
You know, which sometimes people don't see. That's, you know, you can't see everything. But that's our thinking behind it.
I know you're coming out with a cookbook.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
It's a Manresa cookbook. It is the story of the restaurant, you know, the 10 years, the story of the restaurant, told through recipes, photographs, and narrative. We're very excited about it. We have a great publisher, Ten Speed, who has shown a tremendous amount of passion for this project, and we're really excited to working with them. The photographer, the writers, everyone involved, is really excited about it. We're moving forward with that, and that should be available fall 2013.
I can't wait.
No, I can't wait either.
Actually, I have about 10 more questions, but we've run out of time. Can I come back and do this again?
You're most welcome anytime. Anytime.
This has been extraordinary.
Maybe we can do it in Bushwick.
At Roberta's, and you'll get a pizza. You know, Jean-Jour says to me, I'm going to do it out there because I can't get in otherwise. Yeah. Okay, well, this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and I've been speaking with David Kinch of Manresa Restaurant, and we're out here sitting in Manresa in Los Gatos, California. It's been an extraordinary interview. Thank you so much, David.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
And I want to thank Jack Inslee, our producer, and Heidi Tickle and Joe Sevier, my assistant producers on this program. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.